This podcast is brought to you by MITEX, the Massachusetts Innovation and Technology Exchange, the region's premier association for thought leadership, technology trends, building business relationships, and professional training and development. For more information, go to www.mitx.org.
Kenan Sahin was a business school professor before he was an entrepreneur, so he's especially interested in how companies can be designed to churn out innovative products while withstanding the stresses of fast growth. He started Kenan Systems, which developed billing software, with just $1,000, never took venture capital, and eventually sold to Lucent Technologies for nearly $1.5 billion. At Lucent, for a while, he was responsible for the legendary Bell Labs R&D group. I'm Scott Kersner, the at-large technology columnist for the Boston Globe, and I spoke with Kenan early in 2005 in his cinder block office on the outskirts of Cambridge.
I was curious maybe if you would start talking a little bit about the transition that you made when Kenan Systems was founded in 82. You had been for 15 or so years a college professor at MIT and Harvard and I think UMass as well. Yeah. Talk about making that leap to being an entrepreneur. I mean, it must have been a hard thing to go from this very secure lifestyle of college professor to the risky life of an entrepreneur.
Well, I think if one sets out to do certain things, the risks, benefits become articulated and the emotions reflect and parallel those things. But if an undertaking is not fully planned out, you move along without really experiencing the same set of emotions that a deliberate, what I will call a deliberate, as opposed to an inadvertent entrepreneur, might experience.
Were you a deliberate entrepreneur?
I was an inadvertent entrepreneur.
Really?
Although I always had the characteristics of an entrepreneur. If risk-taking is one, initiative is one, taking the unbeaten path is one, being orthogonal and unorthodox is one, if being self-sufficient, saying, look, I'll do this, and if it doesn't pan out, hey, I can sleep on a bench, it's no big deal. So what if I don't have this piece of clothing? I had all those characteristics, but in an academic environment.
Did you at some point have to completely quit your teaching? I mean, was there something you had to give up a salary and say?
I did. And there were several reasons for that, Scott. One is philosophical, I will mention that. And the other one was just time, not enough time. But I would say I became an entrepreneur inadvertently, entrepreneur in the sense of starting a business and moving a business along. As you know, there are many ways of looking at entrepreneurship. A freelance writer, one can say, is an entrepreneur, and so on. But as the business evolved, this was from 1982, by the way, I started the business in some sense to validate some of the things I was proposing in the classroom. And I was sick and tired of people saying, those who can't teach. And when you're in business, in a business school professor, you're trying to teach people, they kind of look at you. If these ideas are so good,
right,
how come you're not doing that?
Right.
You know, what's the matter with you? But also, I wanted to validate some of them, and you collect more data, almost like a field study. But one of my ideas, notions, was that power unchecked can be constructive, but it can also be very destructive. I had always been a proponent of CEOs being balanced by strong boards and by being balanced by countervailing forces, so to speak. So in 1985-86, the business had grown to a point where I could not really do both business and teach and do research. But also, I worried that I was engaged in conflict of interest and all kinds of other things. So I resigned, but then very quickly turned to an independent board actual board. The chairman of my board was Howard Johnson, who's MIT's was former president and chairman. And my reasoning was, if Howard asked me to go to hell, I probably would try to find a way to hell. I respected him that much. Uh-huh. And then he insisted that we bring Jerry Wiesner in. And here I was facing a board of Howard Johnson and Jerry Wiesner, who was Johnson's science advisor, Kennedy's science advisor, MIT's former president, and a huge scientist in his own right. So that was my transition. But once I made the transition, business all of a sudden became very serious.
So reason one was kind of time. Reason two was the conflict of interest issue, or were there other reasons?
Well, it was conflict of interest and, uh-huh. and time. Those uh-huh. were the... and worry that I might not do a good job in either domain.
What was the thumbnail explanation of sort of what Kenan Systems in the 80s set out to do?
It was to implement large-scale system development with new paradigms.
So you didn't initially think of it as, okay, we're going to do billing systems for...
It came much later. Uh-huh. In fact, the original projects were on natural language processing. And we developed premier natural language processing technologies and rule-based processing. Mm-hmm. And in due time, we got into billing because I became convinced, after I learned enough about billing, that that was a good place to apply our what became message repair business, which is an extension of natural language processing, mm-hmm. into billing.
What were some of the things? I'm curious, you know, you were a professor at, business professor at Sloan, I'm guessing,
yeah.
before starting the company. So while you were starting the company, what were some of the mistakes that you made as an entrepreneur that you just wouldn't have thought about beforehand? When your student said, well, you must be so smart, you'll never yeah. make a mistake yeah. as an entrepreneur, you know everything. Yeah. What were some of the mistakes that were instructional for you in the 10 or 15 years that you were building Kenan Systems?
One was choice of a name. Yeah. Uh-huh. It's something that may sound trivial. And I didn't give much thought to the company evolving, I chose a rather esoteric initially name. But I think at the onset, I did not pay enough attention to what I now call organizational architecture. Also, inadvertently, I learned about the importance of contract negotiations. And at the beginning, I think I made a few mistakes.
Contracts with customers?
Customers. Uh-huh. The notion behind a contract is that it's a sale. And if you want more sales, obviously you have more contracts, and you hire salespeople who get you more contracts and so on and so forth. Very quickly, I began to view contract as terms of engagement, and that sale doesn't occur until the whole company delivers.
So kind of almost a working together agreement.
That's right, that's
to
what it is.
Here's what we're selling you.
Yeah. When I finally fully understood that, I in fact turned to our sales team. I'm fast-forwarding now to 1992, when Kenan Systems had genuine technology platforms, not quite products, but technology platforms to sell. I turned to our salespeople and I said, you will not own the leads and you will not have any territories, which kind of surprised them. And in fact, 2 out of 4 left. Undergrounds that this was a very abstract academic notion, that it would not work. And my contention was that we need to synchronize the organization and negotiate contracts, the terms and conditions that would align us with our clients, rather than have a salesperson who's motivated to get a dollar value, and in order to get the dollar value, compromise on a whole lot of terms and conditions. So I said, all leads belong to the company. You are not allowed on your own to go and find a lead and develop that into a sale, which is a very unorthodox notion.
Right, because in a lot of companies, you certainly hear everyone who works for the company complaining about the salespeople, what they'll do to get a contract signed.
Right.
You know,
that's
they'll
right.
give away everything. They'll say, we can do the impossible.
Early on, I realized the downside of that. The upside of that is you can grow your revenues very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
The downside of that is you really disrupt the synchrony, the harmony in the organization. So I said, all leads belong to the company, and the company will take it upon itself, company in the abstract, to generate the leads. And I said, one day, there will be so many leads coming at you that it will be immaterial whether the company owns the leads or not.
Right.
And we did develop a prospecting team, second to none. And what I also discovered, that was also inadvertent, that sometimes when you divide a job, the quality of the people goes way up. Let me explain. If you say sales, and sales will include prospecting, lead development, closing the deal, contracts, and so on, you're really looking for a one-person show that can sniff out the potential areas where the products and services can be applicable, is very good in cultivating, and is very good in pricing, very good in contract negotiations, and so on and so forth. There aren't that many people who can do all of these things at an excellent level. But if you divide it, then you say prospecting, then you can find very high-quality people who love opening up markets.
Uh-huh.
But they hate money discussions, and they hate working on closing a contract. Theirs is the entrepreneurial spirit of opening up frontiers. They really don't want to be settlers. As soon as the frontier is open, they want to move on to a new territory.
That's a great metaphor.
Then you find people who are great settlers. They really don't want to open up new accounts, open up new territories. But if the leads have been teed up and the people have been identified, they don't really view it as sales. They view it as sort of bringing things to a closure. They are so-called great closers. So by dividing up the process like that, I was astounded that we were able to find people from top business schools and engineering schools who wouldn't associate themselves with sales. But they were very eager about what they viewed as market development. These were the people, the pioneers.
What did that do for the company's revenues? Did it hurt revenues in the short term?
That was one of the reasons why, in my opinion, Kinnon Systems really took off in a big way. Because that brought synchrony and harmony to the company.
Talk a little bit about organizational architecture. I mean, most startups and probably most medium-sized companies haven't given it much thought because, you know, you're a startup, you want to focus on the product, and then once the product's done, you just want to kind of bootstrap, you know, how can we get our first sale? And so anyone just kind of does whatever they're good at or whatever they're asked to do.
See, here's the, sometimes it helps to view a situation in an entirely different context. Now, if you want to build a building, you just wouldn't pull all kinds of rocks and stones and bricks and mud and so on and sort of ad hoc build a building. Now, in some parts of the world, that's the way it's done.
Right.
And that's the way the birds do it today. Pull whatever twigs and so on and so forth.
Nest building.
Kind of a nest building and pull it together. It would be just unthinkable these days not to have an architected building. And yet many companies are built in that ad hoc, almost random fashion.
Yeah.
Because I mean, anyone can build an organization. What's the big deal about it? Must be the reasoning. I don't know. So you pull together a few smart people. They start a company. And the idea of a company is you have the boss, yeah, he manages the company, and if need be, he hires this person or he fires this person, and ad hoc the company evolves. Well, that's one way of doing it. But there's another way, which is what I call organizational architecting, to think deliberately about how the pieces and parts will come together, and particularly look at load balancing, synchrony, harmony, and so on and so forth, concepts like that. And in fact, I believe we've done that at length at TIEX with so far very good results. And we did the same thing at Kinnon Systems.
Well, what's an example of how you actually, how you do it? I mean, lots of companies have the org chart, right?
Well,
isn't that organizational architecture?
Well, to an extent. But let me elaborate on this business development model. One is to look at the selling process as really separate from the production process. You go and hire salespeople. You give them their territories. You give them their targets. You give them their compensation plan and commissions and so on. Off they go, run. Now, not that it won't work. It does work. A lot of companies work that way. But when you do that, you create a conflict organization. And it evolves. The opposing forces kind of through time evolve an organization. The other is to really look at the flow and, you know, much like you design an assembly line, ahead of time, you know, consider and pull the pieces together. It's not ad hoc. It is really, this is the way the organization is going to evolve, and you begin to fill in the pieces, much like you build a house. Now, do business schools teach that to an extent? But I don't know of a business school which offers a course in how to build an organization in parts and in pieces. Typically, it's, you know, in passing.
Right.
That you need either it's functional or it is this and it's that. We give much more time to building assembly lines.
I'm curious, we've talked about this before, but tell me about your opinion about why stock options are not the right way to motivate employees when you're trying to grow a company.
Well, I've been, in so many ways, I don't want to maybe use the word vindicated, but anyway, I have. In the early 90s, I remember in an interview like this, when I said I don't believe in stock options, at least not for Kinnon Systems.
It was probably heresy at that point.
It was heresy. The person almost attacked me. He said, that's a self-serving statement. You're doing it for your own. I said, no, it's not true. I said, it's not true. I said that Kinnon Systems, we aim to pay people above market, which we did. And I said, we distribute a lot of our profits to the employees. Not all of it. We have to grow. You need funds. But I said, here's the reasoning. Working for a company is risky enough. Why would you want to take a below-market pay and have the company apply that delta to giving you stock options and then take two chances on the company? You want to invest? As investment is a very noble thing. Why don't you ask for a pay that is commensurate with the market or above market? If you're a very talented person, you should command something above the market. Take that difference and invest it yourself. Don't make the company make the investment decision on your behalf. That was my reason. Now, it doesn't apply everywhere. If the company doesn't have the cash, and that was the argument for stock options, that stock options was a way of borrowing actually from the employees.
Right.
And from future investors and using that borrowed money
To incentivize people to work.
It wasn't even incentivized. People didn't quite understand. They probably had a greater upside if they had commanded a straightforward salary and had taken the difference and invested in other companies.
Not their own company.
Not their own company. It was really a way of financing the company.
What about situations like Google? I mean, do you look at those as anomalies?
As I said, I was commenting more on Kinnan Systems and companies like that. There are many cases where stock options could work, but you could also give restricted stock. Don't have to be stock options. You could create funds in which the employees have a share, but they don't really get the money. But it's tangible. It's out there. It's like a retirement fund and so on, which many companies do have. And I worried about the abuse of stock options, especially at the hands of key executives. Coming back to my early, and in fact, I did raise it in the early 90s. And I said, when you have such things, there could be a lot of back scratching at the top. Yeah, I'd scratch your back, you scratch my back, you get a lot of options, I get a lot of options.
Right.
Who's going to know? Who's going to mind? So long as we deliver. And that kind of reasoning led to enormous abuses, which we saw. So, now does this mean stock options are bad? Not really. It's a tool that should be used with great deal of care. I just was opposed to widespread and almost unabashed use of stock options.
What did you learn from being a professor to being a CEO? What did you learn about motivating employees? I mean, that was Kinnan Systems was the first time you really had dozens and then probably hundreds of employees to motivate.
Well, I never took the title CEO, so in a way, I continued what I was doing in the classroom, a teacher and a learner. And I have accused myself many times of carrying inflatable soap boxes in every pocket, and I'm ready to get on a platform and basically try to pass on some ideas and also learn. So to me, the difference was not that dramatic. It can be, because unlike a professor, when you're the president of a company, you can't really make decisions that affect people's pocketbooks fundamentally. In academia, you make decisions that affect people's minds. You can give them a failing grade, although they can always question that. There are always forums so that professors are not arbitrary. I was accused at Kinnan Systems, the earlier name of which was CMD. On a number of occasions, my colleagues came to me and said, Kinnan, CMD stands for can't make a decision.
What did it actually stand for?
Consultants for Management Decisions was the name. And I said, would you like me to make a decision? I'd be happy to make a decision. It's not that I can't. But I said many times, if ideas are not socialized and they come, are quickly converted into decisions, they will be fiats. I will, in effect, be telling you what to do. Is that what you would like me to do? No, he said, that's not what I like to do. Okay, what is it that you want a decision on? He said, we should organize the company so that it is more, in quotes, decisive, and you should make that decision, Ken. I said, all right, I'd be happy to do that, but what if I told you that if I, in quotes, reorganize the company so that it's more decisive, you will not be a decision maker? Would you like that? He said, I wouldn't like that. All right, I said, let me play back what you just told me. You're telling me that this company should be more decisive, that we should have decisive managers, and you're the key one to do that. So why don't you say so? Then we'll sit down and have a discussion as to whether you can be a decisive manager or not. Now that you've brought it up, I will tell you, you may be a decisive manager, but in that role, you will not be an effective manager. This is not my conclusion. This is the conclusion of people that I've talked to. I didn't like that, of course.
What happened to this guy?
Oh, he stayed on. He stayed on. He appreciated the candor. And uh-huh. We coached each other. In fact, many times I would go to my colleagues and I'd say, look, I'm the president. Don't think I don't need coaching. Coach me. Here's my idea. This is what I propose that we do. You tell me. would coach each other. Uh-huh. We would coach each other, and we would learn a lot from each other. But that's an academic notion. In fact, I don't mean to suggest questions that you might ask, but one of the questions I asked of myself was, how many lessons did I take from academia into business?
Well, let's ask that.
Let's ask that question, see?
I'm a coachable reporter,
Yes, I see. And this was one of them, that there is a great deal of liberation in going to someone who, in quotes, is a subordinate, which is a concept I never accepted. We all have our roles. Genuinely, not as a method of entrapment or anything like that, but genuinely say, look, here are my ideas. Let's, in a collegial fashion, discuss them. Now, the difficulty with that is no matter what you say, your colleague might not believe in your sincerity.
There's always the impulse to suck up if someone is in a more senior role.
Or worry that if I really speak my mind, if I tell this guy it just sucks, what his idea is just rotten, and so on and so forth, he may actually get very angry.
Yeah.
That can happen. But I think that coaching that happens, especially at the graduate level, where the distinction between a faculty member and a student begins to erode, and you're much more collegial, is something I brought. The other one, Scott, is what I mentioned earlier, the power of the human mind. When you're teaching, and you see the evolution inside of a 3-month time frame, it is like a fast motion movie of clouds, or days. You see these things happening. You start out to turn, and these kids don't know much about subject matter. 3 months later, some of them pin you to the wall. And then you go into industry, and the corporate ladder, and you see situations where people will not be allowed to meet with the customers for 5 years. They are in practice, in training. And then when they prepare their material has to be reviewed by 10 people. I said, why not take a chance? But you have to choose the person at the beginning with great deal of care. And if it's a bright mind, capable mind, talented mind, let it loose a little bit and see what happens. I can't tell you how wonderful it was. In fact, at Kinn Systems, we evolved a model that we called AAWE, aptitude, attitude, willingness to learn. So a lot of people lose their enthusiasm to learn. And E was the extra, that was the experience.
And is that how you evaluated employees?
We actually evaluated a lot of employees in hiring stages. Uh-huh. When, in fact, many companies hire just the opposite. You need to have 5 years of experience in this, 10 years of experience in that, uh-huh. 15 years of experience in that. And by the time the person has done all of those things, he's no longer interested in doing what you have in mind. Anyway, that was one lesson I brought from academia.
Is that people have this capacity to learn really quickly. It's just not used in a lot of corporate
I give context. Them the chance. Now, the trade-off is that the error rate is higher initially. If you hire a very talented person and give him much more elbow room, at the beginning he'll make more mistakes than someone who's experienced but not as talented. But once those mistakes are made, the talented person, will come up to speed and exceed very quickly. It's like having an average, really unimaginative, average writer.
Yeah.
It's been doing the same thing for 10 years. You hire that person. He's not going to make many mistakes. You know, it's expected. But you can't expect something really great to come out. You hire someone who has a lot of talent. You give some elbow room. At the beginning, there will be a lot of mistakes, but very quickly there will be that learning. And in a company, it's a difficult trade-off. And what I think, coming back to a question, what I brought from academia was, having worked with students and advisees and so on, this mutual coaching, how to bring people up the learning curve very quickly. The other one was the importance for people of making a difference. In the business world, the assumption is that everything is money, that you pay people enough money, they'll do anything and everything, and if you don't pay enough money, they won't do it, and so on. And, of course, coming from academia, one knows that's not the case. A person gets a PhD, has been top of his class all along, industry offers him 10, academia offers him 30. And he stays in academia. You say, why did this guy make this decision? He has two offers. DuPont has offered him this fantastic job, and it's a combination, but much more importantly, an opportunity to make a difference. It's very important for people. And it's important to reach into that and really understand.
I wonder if you rewind to your childhood and your upbringing, were there some things that happened to you or that you did when you were young that led to you kind of your interest in entrepreneurship and your wanting to teach about entrepreneurship and then also be an entrepreneur?
Well, my father was a great role model, even though I lost him early in a car accident. The man was full of wisdom, and he was a true, in my opinion, multi-stage entrepreneur. And there's an entrepreneur who's great with ideas, but he can't get himself out of a paperback beyond ideas. Then there's an entrepreneur who's not necessarily very innovative, but by golly, once he gets going with something, you know it's going to be done. And so on. But he was a multi-stage entrepreneur. And in fact, one reason I really came to MIT was I was aspiring to be, and I was a physics major. I love physics. I love engineering. I still love them. That's one reason I'm at TIAX. My love for those fields has not diminished. But I figured sooner or later I'd be pulled into entrepreneurship, and I wanted to understand the science of this. And at that time, it was industrial engineering, industrial management. But I think having people around you who are not doctors and lawyers and so on. We had some in my family, but not many. Many more were entrepreneurs.
What business was your father in?
My father was in multiple businesses. He was he owned several plants that processed agricultural products, and he was moving into industrial products. And he would not only carve out new areas, but hire the people, put things together. Yeah. Later on, he went into politics, and I've stayed away from that.
Uh-huh. So far.
I have no intention of going to politics.
Uh-huh. Even though the Bill Clinton book, who knows?
No,
you're using your extra time.
No, it was, but no politics. I think politics is a way of making an impact, I think, and some people are extremely good at it, and I'm glad we have people like that. My aim is to best of my ability, to continue to work with my colleagues here to really make an impact. That's what we did at the Kinnon Systems, too. Yeah, it was impact, making a difference. They were all very important things.
And I guess just the last thing to touch on, when you think about, in some ways what you're doing here is a little bit of a mini MIT, and then you have all these different departments that you get to work with and maybe help guide a little bit. What do you think about as kind of the high-level mission of what you're trying to do when you talk about you know, all these areas like health and wellness and enhanced security and portable power. But what are you trying to do with this organization, with this company?
Well, I think we have positioned ourselves as a linkage company between sources of innovation and uses of innovation. That space, going from the beginning to implementation, is a very difficult space. Many entrepreneurs realize that. I remember going back, my initial joy of having invented something. I'd done something in computer networks, a number of other areas, and I assumed foolishly that that was 90% of the way. It's great, done this now, now the rest will happen. Well, it turns out that's maybe 9% of the way, maybe 5% of the way. There's a whole lot more that comes. That implementation space is where we have positioned TIACS, and working with large companies as well as small companies, we accelerate the transformation of innovations into applications in areas that really matter to people, you know, the health and wellness, the changing home, the home environment, safety and security, you know, portable power, clean energy, clean materials and chemicals. These are really key themes of our day. And we're very well positioned, and we have been doing, I think, big things. One example is in hybrid electric vehicles. We have applied a lot of our portable power know-how focus on assisting American industry in having a hybrid electric vehicle offering on from the battery side. On the changing home, as you know, together with MIT, we built a laboratory. TIACS owns a lab. We operated together with MIT to observe how technologies could really assist in indoor air quality, indoor safety, indoor health, indoor wellness, on the clean chemicals and materials. We are approaching companies to see if we can assist in swapping out the offending ingredients in favor of safer but functionally equivalent materials. In clean energy, we're looking at landfill gases to see if we can more economically convert them to energy. We're looking at diesel as a fuel, which powers our trucks and so on, but can we make it a much more clean burning fuel? Can we eliminate the emission in cars by incorporating newer technologies?
I wonder, as a very last thing, when you had sold Kenan Systems to Lucent and you took on a job at Lucent for a while, I'm sure you had some contract that said, okay, you have to stay for a year or 2 years. No contract.
I had zero contract. People don't know it. I was free to walk the moment the paperwork was signed on officially on February 26th. 1999.
So why didn't you...
That was part of my proposal.
I guess I wonder, why didn't you take the money and retire and go to a beach somewhere? Was that conceivable to you?
I never took the money in a real sense. That was never the idea. And as you know, Lucent came to me personally a good 6 to 9 months prior to the... a transaction, and my answer was flat no. And they said, do you realize how much money is involved? I said, I know it. I'm a former business school professor. I can make my computations, but we're not interested. We're doing well. What changed it was, and I had subsequent conversations, the prospect of being part of Bell Labs, and together with Bell Labs and the 800 people at Kenan Systems, really making a big impact on the software front. And in fact, when the transaction did take place, by the way, we discussed the money at the very end. I did not even bring the investment bankers who were assisting me to the negotiation table so that we would focus on so-called social conditions. Keenan Systems became a wholly owned subsidiary, and later on, at my initiative, we merged with Lucent Software Products Group became the president of that group. So in a way, one can say Keenan Systems either evolved into or became part of a 4,500 software operation with revenues of $1.2 billion.
But, so but you clearly didn't think, okay, that's the time for me to retire or to go back to being a professor.
I would have stayed at Lucent probably a little bit longer if Lucent's management had not changed, and if the usual difficulty, now you know, the market difficulties had not erupted so forcibly. Lucent changed its management, and its direction changed rather dramatically. I can't blame them for that, but it didn't suit me. And I had told them originally, I said, I'll stay 2+ years. So at the end of 2 years, that was a good time to depart. And they assured me they would take good care of Keenan Systems.